Today is August 28th, 2014, and this is Karen Brewster with Dave Klein, continuing to talk about Dave's life. So last time we kind of left off, you were just starting to talk about sort of the philosophies of wildlife management and management policies that have happened in this state off and on. So maybe we'll start with that.
Yeah. Okay. And I've done sort of talked about to Wildlife Alaska chapter of the Wildlife Society at times. I did a few years ago. They wanted me to give a talk on the transition between territorial system versus the state system after statehood. Mm-hmm. And since I worked for the territorial government as a wildlife biologist after I had finished a master's degree and then put my 1 year in the Army during the Korean War, then I got this job to work mainly with deer management and ecological studies based in Petersburg. But I worked throughout Southeast Alaska, and in those days, the job of the biologist, well, I was the only biologist, strictly biologist, in wildlife in all of Southeast then. But my focus was understood to be mainly on the deer, because that was mainly what was being hunted among terrestrial wildlife. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I occasionally did a little work with the moose on the Stikine River, which was aerial surveys sometimes. And then, and that work included, you know, hunter surveys to find out what sex and age deer that were being killed by the hunters, and use that to try to extrapolate the sex and age of the population. But then I initiated some studies of the habitat, the vegetation that was important, especially winter habitat, but also summer habitat. So I was fascinated by habitat relationships. And at that time, the management of wildlife in Alaska was the biologists, the game and game wardens were all federal employees, and technically we were working for the territorial government, but since it was a territory, the federal government had responsibility for management. So it was the Fish and Wildlife Service that we were working for. It was that branch called the Bureau of Sport Fisheries and Wildlife, I think, a branch of the Fish and Wildlife Service. And they had federal aid to wildlife restoration funding, which was part of the Pittman-Robertson legislation, congressional legislation, that portions money from a tax on firearms and ammunition that then went to the federal government, and then the federal government apportioned that to the states on the basis of the size of the state, in other words, how much wildlife habitat they had, but also on the number of hunting licenses sold per state. So it was population-based, too. So it was a formula that included area of the state plus, or territory in this case, and then human population, but it was how many hunting licenses sold was a human population thing. So that meant states like New York, with a huge population and not as big an area as Texas or Alaska, they qualified for the full amount. And Texas and Alaska qualified for the full amount because we had such a large land area. Mm-hmm. And so I think California also qualified, but other states didn't qualify or as much as Alaska did. So it was a, It was certainly a good deal for Alaska because we have had a low population and relatively low population of hunters because there were not that many people in Alaska. But we had a lot of wildlife habitat. And so federal government focus on management did include habitat work, partly because the waterfowl studies, which were migratory birds, were under the federal government anyway and stayed with them even after statehood. But they were interested in wetland habitats from the standpoint of wildlife. And then at the university, the Cooperative Wildlife Research Unit was focused heavily on wetland communities, partly because the head of that program at that time, my advisor, was John Buckley, who was trained with a PhD from University of New York. It's Syracuse, I think. And he had studied a wetland habitat, waterfowl, fur bears that were wetland types. So here, we didn't have the cooperative unit didn't have a lot of support money from the state. They had some from Fish and Game, from the territorial government, but it was minuscule. It was like about $15,000 a year, and of course, and that was divided into maybe three stipends, $5,000 a year per, or maybe more than three, because they didn't pay much for graduate students.
Those were, student stipends.
Yeah, student stipend. Anyway, the unit leader's idea was to focus heavily on Mendel Flats because it was such a short distance from Fairbanks, and they had a cabin that had been built out there, and they did studies of waterfowl, including work with Bryna Kessel, who was a new faculty member then, and she was trained as an ornithologist, and so she could work and advise students on waterfowl studies. But then Buckley would advise students on fur bears, and that included marten and mink and beaver. There were several early theses on beaver, and that was, but not only on the Mendel Flats beaver there, but also in the Chena River, and upper Chena River, a lot of beaver as there are now, and Chattanooga as well. So there was a heavy emphasis on those species, and I was one of the outliers that had become fascinated with hoofed animals, and especially alpine. So I did my master's degree on mountain goats. Mm-hmm. But I worked for one of the fish and wildlife biologists who was focusing on mountain sheep.
Right.
And so I worked for him and had a lot of good experience in alpine areas. And I sort of fell in love with alpine environments and the animals that existed there. So at any rate, the opportunity to get a job was unique at that time. There wasn't a lot of money for this, and the transition from having biologists working in the field was a sort of a new phenomenon after the Second World War. And before that, as always, the game wardens were supposed to make some kind of estimates of what populations were doing, and so hunting seasons were based upon, what hunters thought was the situation, rather than any hard data, because no one was doing any studies.
And the game wardens were not necessarily biologists. They were just out there.
They were law enforcement people, but they also had predator and rodent control people who were controlling animals that were thought to be detrimental to the interests of residents of Alaska. And that included wolves, coyotes, and seals, and even eagles were unprotected until about 1947 or 8. And not only unprotected, but there was a bounty on them, and you could get like 50 cents or so for a pair of eagle's feet. Maybe it was more than that, but not more than a dollar and a half at the most. And so eagles, even though that was considered a national bird and was given protection in other states earlier, and then finally nationally, they were given protection, I think around 1948, something like that. Yeah, but the predator and rodent control people were poisoning wolves in the wintertime by killing seals and putting strychnine baits in the seals and some blubber, seal blubber pills, of strychnine pills, and then putting those in the carcasses and scattering them around. In the wintertime, in theory, the bears were in hibernation, so bears wouldn't be attracted to these. And then they were dropping these baits on lakes and when they're frozen in the winter down in southeast Alaska, and the wolves would be attracted to them. They'd be loaded with all kinds of smelly herring and rotten herring and stuff that would attract the wolves out there. And the theory was, and it was fairly reasonable theory, if you wanted to kill wolves, this was a way to do it, and you could frequently, the wolves would die before they get off of the ice, so you could spot them from the air, then maybe land on the ice and pick up the carcasses. And
no, they were doing this with seals to increase the salmon population?
No, the seals were not protected in Southeast, but they did start controlling seals in some areas, because the seals were taking, it was mainly the seals were, when the salmon were running up the big rivers like the Stikeen and the Copper River, the seals would aggregate and take salmon out of the nets of the drift netters, which was frustrating. Of course, some of the drift netters would have, fishermen would be happy that all the seals would be killed, but they would, it was mainly to stop, they wanted the seals to be reduced or frightened away. They tried frightening them away with explosive charges. That didn't work very well during the salmon fishing season. And so then they also would harass the seals just before the salmon arrived, when they were hauled out on the offshore sand spit. And so the seals would go in the water, and then they'd drop explosive charges in the water that would create concussions and kill the seal. That was the technique of killing seals that were aggregating around the entrance to the rivers. And then they finally passed a law, put a bounty on seals, scalps of seals. And this was territorial legislature that did this. And this lasted into statehood, and I don't know the exact timing of all this. But they also, natives in the North Slope who ate seals on a regular basis, and they said that this was discrimination against them because they couldn't sell the scalps of the seals they killed to eat. And so they did extend the bounty onto the seals, which was then, it was obvious it wasn't a bounty at all. It was a welfare program for the natives. But this was, after statehood, it only lasted for a few years, and then finally all the bounties were eliminated. But it was an era where you killed everything that killed salmon, and with the exception of bears. And especially brown bears were so valuable for sport hunting, and there were a lot of guides that lived in these southeastern communities who were sometimes fishermen part of the year, but they also guided hunters and brought in thousands of dollars a year for them through this guided hunting. And so the bears were protected, even though it was known that some of the troll fishermen, particularly who trolled close to shore in their boats, they didn't like bears because they ate salmon, and they were fishing for salmon. So some of them were violating the law by just shooting bears on the beach that they'd see on the beach and not recovering them at all. So it was difficult to enforce that because there was this bears were bad because they ate salmon mentality. And it was the same with eagles for a while until they finally were given protection. And it wasn't until many years later that it started to be an appreciation for the fact that the salmon were dying. Many of the salmon were taken by bears or eagles were already spawned out, but not necessarily all of them. But then the bears and eagles and the other birds' skulls were scattering these carcasses and were eating them themselves and then passing on the nutrients to their species as they moved around through the landscape. And so then it wasn't until, you know, the 1990s that there were stable isotope studies showing that the nutrients from the salmon, the marine nutrients, were brought up, and the Pacific salmon were unique in this regard. After they spawned, they died and left those nutrients there in the north. And whether the nutrients were passed through bears and gulls and eagles, or whether they just decomposed along the beach, the banks of the streams, the nutrients went back into the streams or into the vegetation by the streams, or was spread around, and even the deer were moving by eating the vegetation close to the streams, were moving it around. The whole watersheds were being fertilized by these salmon. Pacific salmon are unique in this regard. The Atlantic salmon don't do that, and they go back and spawn again. Oh. So this value was overlooked, and a lot of even with the commercial fisheries biologists felt that if too many salmon escaped to get up and spawn, that was bad. This was waste, and it was, you could get too many, and it might destroy the eggs to have too many decomposing salmon there. When, of course, the salmon evolved doing this and evolved this relationship and created very nutrient-rich streams and watersheds that otherwise wouldn't have existed as such. I mean, a sterile stream when a glacier recedes is not very productive until salmon get in it and start bringing nutrients in and build up runs, and eventually the whole system is benefits from the salmon. And this still today, a lot of people don't appreciate how important salmon are. And that means you got to maintain the populations to continue to bring in these nutrients on an annual basis. So it's a case of not understanding how nutrients affected both the salmon and the young salmon that hatched and had to feed in the streams before they went to sea. And the insects they were eating were more available because of the nutrients from the decomposing salmon. But it's an example of how habitat is not appreciated. And it's easier to understand in the case of the marine environment with a species like fish, where it's hard to understand what's going on in the marine environment because we're air breathers and it's very difficult to get information on what's going down and what's going on in the water column. Mm-hmm. So you can't have ships and submersibles everywhere and setting this, and it's just too costly to get that. So you manage the commercial fish on the basis of the number of fish that you think are going to be coming back each year, and you may be able to do some estimates as fish are coming into the river systems for the long rivers like the Yukon and Kuskokwim. It'll give you an idea of how many are going to come through, and then you set the seasons and bag limits on that basis rather than on how many fish were actually successfully produced, how many eggs hatched successfully and young survived and they went to sea. And then the problem, of course, for commercial fisheries when it comes to salmon is who has major responsibility for the salmon. It's split between the National Marine and Fisheries Service, NOAA, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and they're responsible technically for the salmon as a marine fish. And then how do you avoid, catching them when you don't want them to be caught along with other fish? So bycatch. Mm-hmm. But they don't have any control over what's happening in the river systems and streams where they're spawning. And then the state, through say the Fish and Wildlife Service or the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, after statehood, their job was restricted to the salmon in territorial waters and in the streams. So basically the streams, and then they could blame things were not looking good. They could blame it on what was happening in the marine environment, and that was a federal government's responsibility there. And the federal government was sort of acting this in a similar fashion, that the runs are going down. It was because the state was not gathering information on the successful escapement, successful spawning, and successful rearing of a young salmon. And so it was the habitat that was being ignored. Well, going to the terrestrial environment, that where I was working with deer, primarily in Southeast Alaska, we did studies on bears on Admiralty Island, trying to determine how many there were and what effect they were having on the salmon population. But part of our studies showed that there weren't just a few bears, there were a lot of bears, and that they were, during the salmon runs, they didn't move around between streams, they stayed on given streams. And they were connected to the salmon, and the salmon were connected to the bears by the nutrients that where bears were spreading around. So, even if you just argued that the salmon attracted the bears and the bears could be hunted and big money made from them by guide outfitters. So the bears were protected and with open seasons and bag limits, et cetera. But what happened with a transition from federal government with regard to the work I was doing with deer is that I was encouraged to investigate what was required for deer to survive tough winters and was there sufficient winter forage? Were they having a significant impact on the winter forage, the browse that they were feeding on? It was mostly blueberries and extreme conditions, but there were other food available. If there wasn't much snow, there was a lot of food available on the forest floor of dwarf dogwood and other species that we didn't pay much attention to what deer were eating. And so I started getting into studies of what deer were eating and what could it, what effect were deer having on the vegetation, and started building enclosures for one thing. It was very difficult to assess populations because it's a rainforest. It was a rainforest then, and you can't see the deer very readily. You can go into the woods, but you don't know how many you're seeing versus how many you're not seeing. And even when the snows would get very deep and the deer would force down on the beach, there would be, we didn't know how many were on the beach in relationship. We could count the numbers on the beach, but we didn't know many, how many were in the woods. And so we used indirect methods. And finally, we started some other techniques, including pellet group counts in different habitat types, but you could never get to all of the habitats where the deer were because we didn't know. They changed seasonally as the snow depth increased or decreased. Deer moved around the landscape. And we knew that in the summer, the deer, if there were alpine areas above tree line, that a lot of deer moved into those alpine areas because that's where I got started on my PhD studies while I was still working for the federal government. Just before statehood, I was fascinated with why some deer were bigger on some islands than other islands, and what was this forage, or was it genetics? And while we could see that there were different reasons, the bigger deer were frequently where there were deep snows in the winter, and the deer populations would fluctuate widely there. In mild, after a series of mild winters, the deer would population would grow very rapidly, whereas on the outer coast, the western coast, then because of the strong maritime influence, didn't have deep snows, except extremely rarely. And then, so that it was mostly open, and you get storms with temperatures just above freezing, and it'd be rain, and it would get rid of all the snow. Whereas in closer to the mainland, some of those islands, as well as the mainland in Southeast Alaska and the Panhandle, there would be much more difficult winters for the deer. So it showed that the bigger deer came from where the snows were deeper, and where there was a lot of alpine range available. The West Coast, the deer were smaller, and it was largely related to the fact that the quality of the forage, the deer populations would go high and they would reduce the high quality forage, whereas that wasn't happening where there are heavy snows. The deer couldn't get down and clean out the high quality forage. So that mild winters, yeah, the deer rebounded, populations rebounded and produced big trophy sized deer. Whereas on the West Coast, the density of deer was moderately high, but they were all relatively small and the productivity was low. Because it was the quality of the food available to them was more limited. So, you had to factor in hunting pressure and predation pressure by wolves primarily, and made it more complicated. But that was the focus I did. For my PhD studies, I focused on one island close to the entrance, close to the estuary of the Stikeen River, and close to the community of Wrangell, and whereas I was based in Petersburg, and there was an island there, Warankovsky Island, which relatively small. Wolves could get there from adjacent islands, and would the deer went population was high, the wolves would move on, but they wouldn't. It was usually when the population was expanding and the deer weren't greatly impacted by the wolves. And then the other study island for comparison was Coronation Island, which was about the same area, but it didn't have as much alpine habitat, and it also didn't have the extreme snow depth in the wintertime. because it was on the outside coast, and it had no wolves. So that the wolves, apparently because of the small size of the island, the wolves had a hard time getting there, because even though the Kiwi Island was fairly close, there were strong coastal currents and waves that would make it difficult for wolves to swim across channels to get to the island. So that study showed, yeah, that it definitely was a combination of high deer density over time caused a deterioration of, they actually ate out the highest quality plants and types of plants and were forced to live off poor quality forage. And then they were competing with one another for that forage that was remaining. And so the age structure was much older animals and low productivity of young there, in contrast to the other island. And this was, this study was sort of verified by studies going on at the University of British Columbia at that time, where I did my PhD and worked with Ian McTaggart-Cowan, who was my advisor and head of the biology program there. And he was working with captive deer, from some of which I had sent down to him as fawns that had been orphaned, and showing the different feeding that the Sitka deer in southeast Alaska were, which considered the smallest of the subspecies of the black-tailed deer along the west coast, where there's Sitka deer, the northern ones, the Columbia black-tail in the middle and southern British Columbia and Washington and Oregon, and then the California black-tails, which are arid, semi-arid region, and were tended to be larger, and the middle ones larger than the Sitka deer. But in captivity, with provided optimum food, the Sitka deer could grow bigger, actually, than, at least as big or bigger than the others. And their behavior was quite different.
So you were saying that in the territorial days, which is when you were starting and you were doing all this work, they were looking at habitat.
Right.
But that is no longer the case?
And there were, it's not a question of no longer the case, that the focus was no longer there. And what happened was, at the time of statehood, the new the state then had to have a takeover management of fish and wildlife. And so they developed the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, and with a, for wildlife, for fish, there was a division of commercial fisheries and then a division of sport fisheries. And for wildlife, there was what is now called a Department of, a Division of Wildlife Conservation. It was at that time called the Game Division. So their job was to manage harvests and for a sustained basis of the wildlife. This was mainly the big meat-producing ungulates like moose, caribou, and in southeast Alaska, deer, and to a lesser extent, mountain sheep and mountain goats. And so the most of the land at the time of statehood remained federal land, because a state, according to the Statehood Act, could select a large portion, a relatively large portion of land, but a small portion of the total. I forgot the exact proportion. I think it's like about a, well, I can't pull it out of my head at the moment. But initially, this was a slow process. So it was, most of the land was in federal control. So there was national parks, there was national forests, national wildlife refuges had just a few been established, but then there was public domain land, which was landed by the Bureau of Land Management. Mm-hmm. And then, but initially there was no native lands because there hadn't been a native claim settlement, and there was very little private land. Less than 1% of Alaska was in private land. So that the attitude of the Fish and Wildlife Service had been, yeah, habitat is all important for these animals, and it's highly variable in different parts of Alaska in different situations. But the state, when it came into existence, their mandate was not clearly spelled out in the same way as it was for the Fish and Wildlife Service. Their mandate was to, for the Department of Fish and Game, was to manage the animal populations on a sustained basis with no emphasis on habitat. In fact, the state constitution said that habitat fell largely within the Department of Natural Resources. So they had primary responsibility, and they could sort of delegate it to Fish and Game if they needed a focus there. And then it also stated that the Division of Environmental Conservation had a responsibility for water quality in Alaska from the standpoint of human health. So they didn't want pollution to be going on, and the Department of Environmental Conservation would focus, you know, on that, but it's stated in the Constitution that they also were responsible for the quality of water as habitat for fish and wildlife. Now, that's primarily fish, because water itself is not so much a habitat for other mammals.
No.
But nevertheless, their attitude of the State Department was, well, most of the habitat's in federal government, and they have responsibility then for habitat. But the federal government, by the State of the Act, lost management responsibility for the fish and wildlife and retained it for migratory species like the waterfowl. So it was partly, and it's hard to put the blame on the Department of Fish and Game or Department of Natural Resources or Department of Environmental Conservation, but technically all three had responsibility for wildlife habitat. So, but wildlife habitat was federal. And so the tendency was to ignore habitat, and then with three state agencies, none of them took really responsibility to assess habitat. How was habitat changing over time? Was there a significant change? The assumption frequently was made that habitat is, since it's all wild land and hasn't been developed and very little agriculture, it sort of takes care of itself. It's like wilderness. Do you manage wilderness? How do you manage it? Well, we knew that it wasn't that simple. They knew that in interior Alaska, wildfires were normal part of the ecology, but they varied. Sometimes there would be periods without a lot of area burning for 5 years or so, and then suddenly you have a lot of fires in 1 year or two. So they couldn't, no follow-up studies were being done to determine, well, what were the consequences? There was mostly limited observations. There wasn't good quantitative studies that could make the assumption that fires improve habitat generally for moose, but it doesn't happen instantaneously. After a fire, 3 to 5 years later, it starts to become moose habitat, and then it exists for another 25 years before the trees grow out of reach and the spruce dominate, and which is not eaten by the moose and caribou, then they tend to dominate and the habitat deteriorates for moose. Whereas for caribou, a winter forage for caribou is dominated by lichens, which are very slow growing and grow mostly in older growth forest stands that are fairly open. Well, those occur on the northern fringes of the boreal forest, and this is these are the wintering areas usually of the caribou. But fires occur in those areas too. They dry out faster if you have fairly dry conditions. And then fires are mostly lightning caused in Alaska, in interior Alaska. And so it's not a human caused event directly. And so it's the best we could do is say, well, some fires might as well just let them burn. And that is okay up to a point, but you can't let a fire burn if it's threatening a village or cabins and what. You try to protect those areas and the infrastructure that is human caused, because it's very costly to lose these. And but it was not fully understood whether it's desirable to have patchy burns or extensive burns. It was understood that if you have too many fires in the wintering areas of the caribou, then they're not going to have enough forage to support them, and that caribou populations were known to fluctuate over time. But there was a disagreement as to what caused the fluctuation. Was it over harvest and usually blamed in the early days native people, because they didn't have any data indicating how many animals the native people were harvesting. And so it was just, easy to blame somebody. Or they blamed on wolves, of course, as major predators. And then later on, it was shown that bears could be serious predators on newborn calves of caribou and moose. Well, and they went overboard and blamed bears more than other creatures. And eagles in the North Slope killed newborn calves. And so there's a tendency to go for the predators and put the blame on them, even though it may have been a combination of factors. And there are other factors which of the habitat for caribou, for example, they have to forage very efficiently in the summer, in the short summer, where the forage is high quality in the Arctic. But if it's a hot and dry, it may mean the insects are going to be, especially mosquitoes in the early season, and then the warble and botflies can parasitize caribou, and they don't kill them outright, but they can weaken them, and so that they don't grow as well, and therefore productivity can go down, and they might have, if the winter is a severe one, and if they're stressed because of inadequate food, they might have a lot larger die-off and then poor recruitment. So the caribou, because they're so unique in having all these multiple factors that influence them, we didn't factor in habitat changes. And so again, the habitat was ignored by the state in their management program for caribou. Some studies were done, and some of the better studies were done through the Cooperative Wildlife Research Unit, one of the problems with habitat studies is that you don't learn much unless they're long-term studies. Things change slowly. Whereas if you want something to happen fast, well, kill the predators. And so these different approaches were not well organized or designed from a technical basis. Well, during, there was, later when I was a wildlife unit leader, the state was going through the problem of a large segment of the hunters, the sportsmen, were arguing that there were too many predators and there should be more intensive predator control because there weren't enough moose to go around, and the caribou were declining, and they wanted to put the blame solely on predators. And so then there were the environmental groups and some environmental and anti-hunting groups and animal rights groups in the lower 48 particularly were threatening to boycott tourism in Alaska because we were just shooting wolves from the aircraft, just using that as an excuse to bring about recovery of moose populations. Or often it was the other factors were ignored. Severe winters, for example, were ignored. And winters reduced availability of forage, made it more costly for animals to forage for their food, and buried some of the good quality food in the snow. And these were overlooked, and fire was not adequately understood and was overlooked. So habitat itself was not examined, and none of these agencies in the federal government restricted their studies of animal populations to federal lands that were national interest lands, like Forest Service and
the parks
and the national parks and wildlife refuges primarily. And so and Bureau of Land Management really didn't have a mandate for managing for wildlife. And so it was easy for the state, from a budget standpoint, to focus only on factors which they could relate directly to population, animal population dynamics. But that was excluding the role of forage and herbivores and how they may change, availability may change, and both in relationship to the density of the animal population, but in relationship to fires and recovery from fires, which what lichens require, close to 50 years to, if it was been severely overgrazed or following a fire, it might be 100 years before you're getting a good lichen stands coming in, or even longer. We didn't have this kind of information available, and it's the kind of information that you can only acquire through long-term studies. And there are some long-term studies of fire ecology, but we're still not in a position to prescribe how fire under different fire regimes, that, for example, if it's what kind of vegetation was there before the fire? Was it white spruce dominated? Was it white and black? Was it black spruce? Was it wetlands? Was it birch and spruce dominated? When was the last fire in that area before this one? And how was what was the heat of the fire? Was it dry very dry, and so that burnt down to mineral soil? Or was it patchy and made it easier for the vegetation to recover more quickly? All of these factors were so complex and remain that way that we still have so many questions about fire ecology that we can't draw firm conclusions about specific areas. We can generalize a bit, but we can't do it for specific areas. And then we have to factor in more human activity and more some increase in agriculture and clearing, and then the climate change.
Now, you had started to say that the wildlife unit was doing research. So the state was not doing research related to habitat. They were doing this population dynamics. But you're saying your students and faculty were doing more habitat-based research?
Well,
and if so, how come that information wasn't being
well,
used?
I shouldn't say that it wasn't just the wildlife unit. The university itself in the Department of Biology and Wildlife in the Institute of Arctic Biology, they were also people who were, say, botanists and plant community structure people who the wildlife unit was melded in with the department and the Institute of Arctic Biology primarily, and for administration and financial management, so that sometimes we were doing studies that we can't take full credit as wildlife unit studies. The funding was coming from state or federal government usually. So some of the refuge people might want us to fund a study, or the Forest Service would fund a study, or the state would fund us through the Department of Fish and Game. They would fund a study because their budget wasn't sufficient to hire a person and full time to do it. So they figured that, well, this is a controversial issue, let's go for it. And this cooperative unit had the real advantage when there was an issue that was challenged both the state and federal government. They tended to polarize and say, well, either we do it or you do it. Whereas when they could do it through the unit and both contribute some funding, then the project could be done in a less expensive way. And if it was a master's student, for example, the answers to the specific questions could be accomplished in a couple of years associated with the student thesis project. And so that was done, especially when animals were in new areas, for example, like the Arctic Refuge was established. Well, state had some responsibility there. The federal government had some sort of responsibility. The Canadian government, through the Yukon Wildlife Ranch and the Canadian Wildlife Service, had, because it was an international herd, the porcupine herd. Well, the cooperative unit was frequently able to play a role of working with funding from multiple sources. And one advantage of this is that if one agency had provided the funding and they got a budget cut, whether it was federal or state, the other agencies, they couldn't get away by just saying, we're going to stop the study, because the other agencies in other states or countries would say, no, we made a commitment, we have to follow through on it. So it was usually the amount of money was not great that each component contributed, but put together and made for a successful project. So the real advantage of this cooperative unit program was state and federal worked together frequently, and through the unit, the students get better experience and training. They frequently, some of the support from one of these agencies was, say, aircraft support or other type of logistics support to get to boat support in Southeast Alaska to get the students to the areas. And this was helped to avoid polarization between state and federal agencies or even federal agencies themselves within that, or state agencies. So it's you can't put your finger on one state or federal agency and say, well, these things weren't done, even though they were primarily responsible for it. You have to factor in the fact that both at the state level and the federal level, the budgets change politically and seasonally and with the changes in the economy. And you can't put all the blame on on one component over time. And it's better to have a cooperative program of this nature for, in this particular case, wildlife habitat studies. So we did more studies through the wildlife unit, and my own work there was the master's thesis was habitat. In Southeast Alaska, it was the University of British Columbia that I was working for the degree, but it was habitat related. And I collaborated and did had exchange programs with British Columbia, and especially Vancouver Island, where they had a lot of experience with deer, which we hadn't, and logging, which we hadn't at that time when I started, much experience with logging. So there was a lot to be gained by these exchanges. And at first, that, to me, it was quite obvious that Alaska should be sort of international in how it operates in terms of biological studies and environmental studies. And I've always, since then, it was easy to move to take opportunities to do comparative studies in other countries of the world, especially in Arctic ecology issues. Mm-hmm. But it was, and we had the advantage too. I mean, Alaska is our closest neighbor, was Canada, and we had a program where at the University of Alaska, that where students from Yukon, Northwest Territories, at that time, and still is the case, I believe, they could come to the University of Alaska and pay in-state tuition. And then we created a similar one when they, after the new university was created in northern British Columbia. And there we still have that agreement. That students from Alaska can go to northern British Columbia on a similar kind of arrangement. So this, it's, we can learn a lot by learning what's done in other similar areas, and that includes Canada and the whole Circumarctic countries, where ecosystems and ecosystem dynamics are similar in many ways, but they are different and very frequently benefit. We generally always benefit by exchanging information and exchanging students. Student exchanges of coming from those countries to here and vice versa. Mm-hmm.
But I was thinking, so if you guys were doing all these habitat research with this state and federal funding, the results of your research were available to those agencies to use in their management decisions, and it sounds like they were still not using that information.
Well, yes and no. You have to look, realize that the co-op unit had, in those early days, we might have only 5 graduate students. And you spread those around on different, say, waterfowl projects and Middle Flats occasional study of caribou. And a lot of the studies weren't focused solely on habitat, but they were was part of the we're looking specific herds. For example, the 40 mile caribou herd student project would be on aspects of calving and the calving grounds. So for a master's project, you couldn't take the whole picture. You could only do parts of it. And yes, some of this information was used by Fish and Game. In other cases, you could probably say it wasn't used much because they didn't feel it was needed. It wasn't what they was critical at the time. And so it's always the case when there's good science is being done, it isn't necessarily applied right away. And that has to do with, the momentum of existing programs frequently doesn't make room for major changes which should occur when data becomes available and studies are done. So it's not a perfect system, and especially ecological studies, which are, if you're studying animal populations in relation to the environment, or ecological studies, are very complex, and the return is slow in terms of information. And they frequently gets polarized by the user public, in this case, say, the hunters, who would trappers or fishermen, depending on what you're talking about. And a student thesis project may not be enough to convince the general public that some change is necessary, because it may not provide enough information. It's a start, say, but it may not provide enough information. And jumping to conclusions when you don't have enough information is a mistake also. It may reflect poorly on the research that's done if you jump to conclusions when you still don't have a good answer. When nowadays we talk about modeling whole systems, because you can do that more effectively with computer models. But it acknowledges that modeling is a way of dealing with complexity and making it more understandable, but it doesn't say that you can duplicate the natural environment and draw conclusions as to how to proceed in the future, because when you're modeling, what you do learn is there's a lot of information you don't have yet and can't get yet. And sometimes we don't have the technology to get it yet, but maybe 5 to 10 years down the road, it is possible. And it's, for example, there's been some good advances in use of radio collars on caribou, so that we can better locate the herds and components when we want to do an aerial count, or we can tell where they are, and then we go and check and what kind of habitat are they in at a given time of the year, and when are they there? Is the conditions ideal for them there in those areas from the standpoint of the forage and or predation pressure higher there than in other areas if they'd not gone there? I mean, it gets so complicated that it's hard to get the public, let alone members of Congress or the legislators or even fish and game biologists, the management biologists themselves, to convince them that we have enough information to draw firm conclusions. So it's not an exacting laboratory type of science where you have control over all of the variables. And that's what it tends to boil down to. But on the other hand, just ignoring, say, habitat is not a solution. And that's, to a large extent, that's what's happened with the state government over time, that habitat is ignored. They use other techniques such as, body condition. What are the body condition of the animals? How does that tell you about the habitat? Well, it sometimes tells you things, but if you should go out and look at the habitat and see whether it fits with what is there. And we just don't look at habitat. Part of the problem nowadays is we have these new technologies for remote sensing with satellite imagery and radio collars, and we don't spend enough time, management biologists don't spend enough time in the field with the animals. The best information they get, they think, is by looking what's coming through their computer from, say, satellite images, images or satellite locations of the animals, and well, this is where they are, and they must be doing this and that, but they don't, they're not on the ground. What is snow conditions, for example? How deep is the snow? Is the snow, what is the energy cost of animals moving? They don't have that kind of data from satellite images. And so there's some things you can get, but you should have the work on the ground, and you should have people on the ground. And that's hard, especially if, well, one of the students I had worked on the energy cost of migration in the spring to the calving grounds. And you got to be with the animals quite a lot. Measure snow depth and hardness. While they're migrating, it costs energy to move through snow. So they tend to, in the springtime, where they're heading for the calving grounds, they try to move at night. And of course, the light has pretty much come back, so it's almost 24 hours of daylight. But it cools at night because the sun is low, and then the snow hardens up, and then it's better for them walking. But they have to feed, too, because they don't want to draw down all their fat reserves. They still have, females still have to give a bear a calf when they get to the calving grounds, and then they have to produce milk for it, and they're under greater physiological stress for better quality food and nutrition after they give birth to the calf rather than when they're pregnant, because the calf is growing very rapidly and it's drawing initially on the milk of the mother. And so she has to have optimal food available and feed almost 24 hours a day and take breaks to digest the food and ruminate, and they don't sleep much. In the wintertime, they might, as I said, eating poor quality forage, and it's digests more slowly. Their whole physiology changes. They run this food through their gut so fast, and it's high quality, new green vegetation that they get, getting all these good nutrients. But if they can't feed on them because they're harassed by insects, or by predators, then they are going to suffer and will not be in as good condition in the fall if it's a summer that's very good for the mosquitoes and flies, parasitic flies, but not for the feeding by the caribou.
Mm-hmm. Well, as you say, it is so complicated that understanding these animal populations and what they're doing and why they're doing it, and it's all these factors. So how do you end up being able to make a decision or understand what's happening at any one point in time?
Well, part of the problem is you've got to realize that there are multiple factors, and therefore we should have an eye on them. And that's where I say habitat is an important factor, that we should have a better eye on it. Now, we don't necessarily have absolute information, but if you take the simple way and say a cause and effect relationship by the average hunter, well, look, we hunt them, and we don't have long enough seasons now, and there aren't enough animals to go around. It must be predators, because that's, they can see a cause and effect relationship. Then they don't, it's hard to get them to, they go out there and hunting, and everything is green. And at the beginning of the hunting season, they think there's no shortage of food. It's a green world. Well, that's not true. I mean, people starve to death in the green world if there's not edible food. Mm-hmm. And it's even more difficult when animals are living so close to their physiological capabilities in a northern environment where summer is short. They have to eat and grow and do most all of their growth in the summer and reproduction and nurturing the young. And then the wintertime is long, and they have to be able to survive that winter based on the previous summer. And well, that's why there's so few animals up, and you go higher into the Arctic, the density of caribou goes way down. If there's a few there, You can't have the big herds.
The habitat just can't support it. The ecosystem can't support
That's true, yeah. And not support the situation there's, for example, in the work I did in northern Greenland, focusing mainly on muskoxen because there are no caribou there, but there had been caribou. And there were caribou there until about 500 years ago. And then looking at old bones and set antlers of caribou, that caribou weren't there continuously in the earlier times than 5,000 years ago. They were there, and then the population would die out. And where did they come from? Well, they came across from Arctic Canada to northern Greenland. The muskoxen stayed during these times when the caribou died out. And so northern Greenland now doesn't have caribou, but it does have muskoxen. So the muskoxen were able to persist in small groups, and of course the wolves would die out when the prey population went way down, and the wolves had to come back again when the caribou increased, which they did, but they were absent for 60 or 70 years. And so the muskoxen could get by on poor quality food in the wintertime, whereas caribou lived a more energetically costly life in the winter than muskoxen. Muskoxen are very conservative energy-wise. They don't move around much. They stand their ground for predators instead of running. And they don't have to be as selective for food. Caribou have to select food that is readily digestible, high in energy, and lichens are a good one. But lichens grow even more slowly in the Arctic, and a little bit of grazing by a caribou, the lichens aren't able to produce enough forage. So the caribou that grow up there have to live off of, dwarf willows and buds and high quality food, but it's not very abundant. So the animals have to move over a vast territory. They can do it fairly efficiently in the winter because there's not much snow. It's a polar desert. But they don't have to spend a lot of time wading through snow or digging through snow for forage. But it's just not simple for them to. And there are wolves that they have to deal with too. So it's not much human harvest, but there's some.
Well, they say it's all so complicated that, how do you ever know what all the factors are? You know what the factors are, but how do you know which is more or less a factor?
Well, that's a good point, and that's exactly the case in managing any kind of wildlife in northern extreme, and the same would be true in desert areas. It's very difficult because you can't be aware of all of these. Even in Africa, we hear about conditions where suddenly elephants are being threatened, whereas in other situations, the population may be booming. And then you have to factor in the human element. And then the major predators on elephant calves, which are lions, but it's not simple. And then, of course, then the water is a key factor in those areas and have drought situations.
Well, and here you have to factor in the human hunting element, at least for certain species.
So we can, this is, we've been talking about terrestrial environment and the marine environment for, say, fish and particularly salmon. We have the same problem. We don't have enough information about the environment in the terrestrial situation in rivers and streams. And we certainly don't have enough in the marine environment. Plus, we're catching other fish that are probably related to, they're feeding on the same, those other fish are probably feeding on the same thing salmon are, and some of them are feeding on young salmon and vice versa. So we don't have that kind of information. So how do you manage? You manage on the best information you have available, and sometimes it's proven not enough. And that's usually the case in commercial fishing in the marine environment. We overharvest. As long as you can catch fish, they think there must be more coming. And they base it for major fisheries, you base it on the size of the fish that you're catching, and then the younger ones that you catch along with them. Are they going to be as many fish the next year as there were this year? And so that's probably the best if you don't have any more information. But if you have more information, maybe there's other factors involved. And then we have, and nowadays, of course, we have to factor in climate change, and we know very little about what's going on in the marine environment associated with climate change. We know that the seas are getting warmer and that they're getting more acidic, but we still don't know what the long-term consequences of that are. We can speculate, and we do that sometimes beyond what's reasonable in terms of what knowledge we have. And the same would be true in freshwater fishery management, where on the one hand, we can say there's more spawning streams coming into existence as glaciers recede, and that's true. But we're not doing adequate studies to determine how soon that happens after the glaciers recede, and is it happening fairly rapidly, or is that overcompensated for by other factors such as drier, longer summers, more melting, and are some streams that have already been good salmon streams declining in quality because of that factor? We don't know that. And then you get new things coming in, like if you see some kind of a disease or parasites, and we do see that sometimes with fish and salmon coming back. Well, it's what caused that? Was it a phenomenon we don't know anything about, or is it associated with too many fish and in one area, or is it some introduced by, say, agriculture with salmon in cages, or when we got hatchery production of salmon in the coastal areas that seems to result in increased harvest of fish coming back to the hatchery. Well, is this positive or negative for the other fish that are out there competing with them for food? Is that competition significant? And how is it affected by the other species of fish coming in, moving north into the waters that were primarily where they weren't present previously?
Well, and the other thing with disease, not only fish, but you hear periodically somebody on the North Slope who finds a caribou that has something unusual, and they report that.
Right. And we know that disease has been there in the past, and probably there have been times when it seemed to be more common, but we don't have a good enough data from PIRS studies that were focused on disease. Disease has never had too much attention. There's been more attention on disease in Canada relative to caribou than in Alaska. And part of it is because the native people in Canada were more concerned. Well, there's more caribou scattered across northern Canada, but in different herds. But there were other problems that that made may not be considered disease, might be pollution from contaminants from industrialization, but sometimes it is related to disease as well. And so Native people understandably want to know more about these. Is there any risk in eating these animals that appear to have some problem? Yeah, that's normal human behavior and wise to know. And Canada has made some good advances, but it's pretty complicated. And it's some of this is happening in Alaska too, and that there's much better. The university is doing more, putting more focus on animal diseases and checking for heavy metal presence in the tissues of animals for mercury is a chemical of concern, and we know that there's been problem areas in the world with excessive mercury and effect on humans eating fish. And how's that Alaska compared to other areas, and is it changing or is it stable? Yeah, it seems overwhelming, but there are people working in virtually all of these areas, and we can't lay it all onto the management agencies. I mean, it has to be the universities have to play a major role, the research components. But I think the oversight by the federal government is definitely needed, and sometimes it's not there because that costs money too. And when the budgets are tight, frequently we don't look at these things.
You know, and some of it too is the human management aspect. You know, you were talking about the salmon, or I think about, well, or moose hunting. People are so accustomed to being able to harvest these animals that they fight very hard. They do not want to give up those opportunities.
That's right. Yeah.
So then the wildlife managers are dealing with managing people as much as they're trying to manage for the animal population.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, it's wildlife management, you could say, is a social science because you're dealing with people to a large extent. But obviously, it's a social science in one regard, and it's a biological science, and the environment is both biological and physical, and so it's very complex, and it's not simple. And the mistake frequently is assuming one of the, you could say, successful management is getting the users to understand what's going on. Mm-hmm. And it may mean population is going down for, let's say, climate change or something like that. And if good management, their users are informed. And so sometimes it's something they can take some action on themselves. But if they know what's going on, they can perhaps do this. And, if there's a decline, say, in caribou or in some areas, or marine mammals, then regionally the native people may decide, well, let's move some of the meat from areas where we don't have a problem of overharvest and reduce the harvest in those areas that have been overharvested and make the meat available to these other people. So that sometimes can happen, but it requires understanding by the users of the resource. And that's true in general. And some people want to see wildlife. Tourists want to see wildlife, and hunters want to kill more wildlife. And there's plenty of wildlife, and you can't, if you hunt them in areas where people want to see them, well, maybe you can argue that if you don't take too many, that's not But what you might be doing is training the animals to be more wary and be less visible. And is that, from standpoint of wildlife management, that's not a goal if your job is to try to make animals available for people to see. On the other hand, you don't want to make them tame. So it's just like a zoo, an outdoor zoo. And so, you know, it can be argued that some hunting is desirable, and I think that you can argue that in places like Africa as well, that some hunting is desirable because animals are used to predators. If you clobber the predators and there's no hunting, and without hunting, the animals become tame.
I've never heard that before. Your thing about wildlife viewing versus hunting makes me think about wolves at Denali, where that is certainly a...
Well, then it's the predators are of interest to people who want to see wildlife. Whereas the hunters, they want to see the products of what's the prey. They're only interested in the prey. It's if you're interested in the whole system, what people are encouraged to do if they're going into national parks, that's good if they can see them. But they have to realize that the density of predators versus prey is very low, and that's the way it normally is and should be. And the prey predators often are wary. So if the predators are not hunted, then they could be a problem. And one of the problems in Denali Park is the moose tend to, female moose, pregnant moose in the eastern part of the park, move down into the park headquarters area where the tourists are, and there's not as many bears to prey on the moose calves. But the bears are starting to learn that that's where a good place to get moose calves, and therefore results in more interaction between people and bears, which is not particularly desirable.
Yeah, I was thinking about the wolf issue, how they're saying, you know, that there's one perspective is there are fewer wolves visible along the park road, claiming it's because they're all being hunted on the boundary, and
right.
Then of course the hunters will say something different.
Well, there's a relationship there. That's true, and I don't know how significant it may be. I mean, it's a very difficult situation. Of course, a lot of tourists want to see things, but they don't necessarily want to understand. Or they don't make the effort to understand.
Or nobody's trying maybe to teach them.
That's true. That's sometimes the case.
Maybe a combination, yeah.
But if, for example, you know, if you want to see, say, ptarmigan females with chicks, well, the female is, if there's birds of prey around and foxes, then they're going to... be very wary. They have to be if they're going. Chicks are going to survive, and the same would be true of other animals. They're going to respond in relationship to the threats to their well-being, and the predators are going to do the same thing. Or, if they can't get what they need, then they go someplace else, especially. Aerial predators, hawks, owls, eagles.
It's easy for them to go someplace else.
Pardon?
Maybe it's easier for them to go someplace else.
Definitely. I think the owls and big hawks do that. Readily.
Mm-hmm. Well, sort of the last thing is thinking about this, the human management side of it all, is that often turns into a political pressure.
Mm-hmm.
And how do wildlife managers, how do you handle that once it sort of becomes a politicized issue?
That's no easy way. When things become politicized, there's no simple solution. I think this, the best solution from the standpoint of wildlife management is to try to stay as objective as possible and try to serve the interests of the, put major emphasis on the well-being of the resource, and then its allocation is, you'd leave that up to the some fair method, and there aren't very many, like the Board of Game, and then you get conflicts between federal and state and overlap, that kind of thing. And but yeah, and you can't, there's no one tourist that's going to be representative of all tourists. There has to be some kind of oversight by the agency that's managing for tourism.
Well, and the thing about the fair method of allocation, of course, gets into questions about, well, who's making that decision? That's a Board of Game, for instance, and who's on that Board of Game?
Right.
Is it a fair, is it quote unquote fair?
Yeah.
But maybe you don't want to comment on that.
Well, its attempt originally was to have a fair system. The problem is we don't have balanced membership on the board, and that's been a political issue, because the governor approves membership, and the board can recommend people to fill vacancies or replace vacancies, right? And the governor can, they can recommend even removal of people from the board, and the governor can approve of that. That's where it becomes political. When it becomes political, then the only thing is, the best way to deal with that is for the those people in the public who want a fairer operation to make, to focus on the fact that it's not fair and that should be adjusted and corrected. And that's a political process too.
Mm-hmm. Well, so what do you think about, so there's people on this Board of Game who are making these allocation decisions, but they are not biologists. They are users. And should the people be making these decisions be the biologists and the managers who understand the, who in theory understand the bigger picture?
Well, according to the legislation, as I understand it, setting up the Board of Game, is there, they're supposed to resign, to base their decisions on allocation on information provided by the biologists, who they present every year before, every time before a board meeting. The biologists submit, are expected to submit their recommendations. There also are advisory committees that are made up of users, and that again, there it should be all of the users of the wildlife, but it's usually only the WOAS that are most active users, like the hunters. So tourists obviously can't be represented very well on the board.
Well, a tourist organization, the tourism industries could somehow
They could be, or in the case of a park, they could have someone from the park sitting on the local board. And there are cases like there's one case of co-management, sort of like co-management for the Western Arctic Caribou Herd. There's a good example that where it was the Department of Fish and Game that came up with this idea, the local biologists who were working with, to some extent, with Native people and with representatives, federal agencies, and hunters, non-Native as well as Native hunters, and then registered guides and outfitters. And so they argued for and sort of initiated an effort to create a co-management board. In other words, that the decisions regarding management of that herd wouldn't go to the Board of Game. It would go to this board, the co-management board, which had the users outnumbered the managers. So that the Native, in that case, the Native population, the Natives were had the majority of the members of the board, so they had a stronger potential vote. And this was a model that was tried in Canada and still tried there. It's worked well in the Western Arctic herd, much better than in Canada. And the advantage of this is that all of these people with interest, they're mainly users, including the outfitters and others, and the representatives of the wildlife refuge and the park, because the refuges and even the park preserves this hunting allowed. And so there's a voice, they have a voice, and but they acquiesce to those, to the Natives in the case of the parks. But the advantage of this is that the users that are on this board are informed about what's going on by all of the agencies, and especially by the so they can see it from the different perspective of this. And that's good government, really, when that happens, because people talk to one another, but they also are aware of what kind of survey work is being done, and what kind of information is available from what kind of information is Department of Fish and Game gathering, say, on body condition of animals, on radio coloring and where the animals are located seasonally. They can produce good printed material that has to be funded, of course, and that was, and Fish and Game had initially been started it, but it's other agencies are contributing that benefit from it. And it includes Park Service and Wildlife Refuges, Bureau of Land Management, and Fish and Game. And so that means some financial assistance to get the members of the board present when they meet, so that particularly Natives or from villages which wouldn't be able to have money out of their budget, so they don't have a budget in order to get there. And it's a system has worked quite well for that herd.
But even in that case, it's users making decisions about allocation. And so my question is, having a system with, like these boards where it's membership of users versus why aren't all those allocation decisions made by the staff of Fish and Game, who are the biologists who are...
Well, the biologists are there on the board. There's representative of the Fish and Game biologists on the board. they just don't have the numbers to, if it's a controversial issue, they don't have the vote.
So what do you think about this system where there are these boards that make these decisions versus having scientific staff of these departments making those decisions?
Well, they mostly don't, scientific staff, in terms of wildlife harvest. I mean, maybe in the Park Service they do, but they're not a question of harvest there.
Right, but so why can't a Department of Fish and Game be making decisions about harvests? Why don't they have a staff people who do that? Why do you have to have a board of game doing that?
Well, how would they know what would the people would prefer to have in terms of seasons and bag limits and stuff? Seemed to me the hunters should have a voice in this, as well as other users. Yeah. So I mean, it's just. Well, some of the things that happened in Canada when they first started this co-management is native people were thought, well, that sounds like a good deal. But then one of the first things they did was they didn't like putting radio collars on caribou. They said they have a certain respect for the animals, and they thought this doesn't fit with their culture. And so they stopped, they had to stop the provincial and Canadian Wildlife Service had to stop this radio collaring for 2 or 3 years. And then the natives that were on the board began to realize, well, it's true, it's a problem, but we need this information if we're going to do a better job of management. And so they were happy to get an acknowledgement that those people that were radio calling would be more respectful of the animals that they were handling, and which seems a reasonable request. And it's changed a lot in Alaska. I remember, it used to be, for example, in territorial times, only ravens were protected in southeast Alaska because it was part of their the Tlingit and Haida culture. The raven is highly respected, and they have clans, relationships to animals. Whereas in interior Alaska, at that time, partly because there was less interaction between native and non-native cultures, but because the population of natives in interior was very low relative to southeast Alaska, a different resource base mainly. But there were other areas where
in the southeast the ravens were protected, but in the interior they were not.
No. Okay. And hunters didn't. It was sort of like crows. I mean, they in the south, in some areas where you didn't have a lot of things to hunt, people, would. Crows could be quite edible, and, mm-hmm. and ravens could be edible too. But it was the respect. And once it was the natives in their culture frequently take the attitude when acculturation is occurring that, well, we don't want to drag our feet about issues like this. If the non-natives don't want to shoot, we respect all animals, they would take it, mm-hmm. and we respect the ravens too. And If you're not going to eat them, why would you shoot them? Which is a good question. But it can be sporting, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
You know, why shoot a clay pigeon rather than you can shoot a real live pigeon? Or
and so were ravens actively hunted in the interior at that time?
No, but they were shot occasionally.
Yeah.
I remember I was out with grad students and the, you know, we were sitting around the campfire and we were on the 40-mile area. And this one guy, Cal Lensing, he was a great waterfowl hunter. So he was a good shot on, wing shot on birds. And the only thing we could hunt then that was here were grouse, and they were frequently spruce grouse. So we, this was in November or something, we were camped out up there on the Taylor Highway, and we had shot a couple of spruce grouse, and so we put them in the pot and skinned them and put them in the pot to boil, and that way I put some salt and pepper in with them. Maybe we put onions. We probably didn't have a lot more. And we're sitting around and they're cooking, and this raven flew over. And Cal had his shotgun right beside him, and he picked it up and he shot this raven out of the air. I came down and I said, well, let's put it in the pot. So we put it in the pot. And yeah, it was edible along with the spruce grouse. And spruce grouse, was, some of them were pretty sprucey flavored.
Maybe the raven,
and we were hungry.
Maybe the raven helped mellow the spruciness.
And then there was an annual game dinner that the wildlife chapter...
The Wildlife Society?
No, the university had a wildlife club.
Okay.
And so we would put on a game dinner. Well, we had sometimes mystery foods. We would, some trappers would turn in carcasses for us, like lynx and other carcasses, including wolf. And so if it was fresh killed, we would frequently just dress it out and save it for the game dinner, put it in the freezer. And so one time we put raven out and as a mystery meat on plate, along with the grouse, and we had ruffs. I think we had sharp tail and ruffed and spruce grouse, and but we put. We'd have, usually have some mystery meat, and we'd ask people to tell us what it was, and the raven came out pretty hot, but. You know, we put bay leaves and spices and stuff in, and it was usually cold afterwards. It had been cooked and it was put out, and so they could pick up some and taste it. And yeah, the raven came out okay, and then we did this with wolf once, and it smelled terrible when it was being cooked in the old main building, but it. Was cooked and with bay leaf and some onions or stuff with it, and then sliced. It was the back legs, I think, sliced thin, so it couldn't tell it from, say, mountain sheep and other things, and put it up there, and the wolf came out really high. But I remember tasting it, but we did. Cook it one time, and that the odor was, we got rid of that, much of that stuff, apparently.
So it came out high, meaning people really liked it?
Yeah.
People voted and they liked it?
Yeah.
Did people guess what it was?
No.
No.
Not in the case of the wolf. We had to tell them after the fact. But they, you know, it reminds me that in the bear hunting, now, there was a problem, you know, the big bear hunters, they like to, you can get your name in the record book if you based on the skull size. And it's, you go to official measure, and we're at Boone and Crockett Club, and and they measure it. And there was a problem in down in, and I think it was in the Bristol Bay area, the native people there, they didn't, they, and then you had to turn in the skull when you harvested.
Right.
And the native people didn't want that. They believed that the skull should be turned, go back into the woods and decompose. At that time, at least, and they ate the a brown bear meat, and so they did harvest them for eating, and so they objected to this, and I forget how it was resolved. But this was several years ago that that happened.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, it's like the different cultural attitudes, and it's important, especially when, you know, the subsistence hunters usually aren't well represented on advisory boards because they don't think they don't think they're going to have much voice. It'll be overridden by these urban people.
Well, and also, are the subsistence regulations managed differently than the recreational hunting regulations? So do they, does that board make subsistence, does the game management, the Alaska Board of Game's decisions affect subsistence hunting?
Yes and no. I mean, in the things, in most cases, state law doesn't allow distinguishing on a racial basis for qualifying for subsistence.
Right.
So it's based upon your history and residence in an area, whereas the federal government does recognize it.
Well, and there's the whole
problem
of state versus federal management of subsistence and that political battle that's been going on.
There is a federal subsistence management component, and their job is primarily to work out, but I don't know the exact wording of this, but to work out the system so that the federal, I mean, in some cases, the only native people are allowed to do things like shooting and sea otters.
Marine mammal hunting, yeah.
Yeah. But there are these problems, too, of subsistence hunting of other things. And usually there's, well, they make, but even that, that's, it's challenged every time it goes. Like traditionally in native communities, they hunt for people who can't hunt, the widows and older people,
right,
especially older women. And so now they allow sort of a party permit so that hunters can take something and give it to someone else.
You can assign a proxy hunter.
And I think now that's been challenged, and they can do it for non-natives too, a similar kind of thing.
But yeah, the subsistence management is a whole nother
it's
complicated scenario.
It's unique to Alaska, and it's a very, it's been a very complicated and difficult issue to deal with. It's a major challenge, and in retrospect, I think Alaska's done moderately well. I mean, by that I mean both federal and state have done reasonably well in trying to handle this, and the at first, you know, there was this tendency that the federal government would back off and let the state do its thing, but then they weren't fulfilling their responsibility regarding federal law. And, you know, it's in the long run, you know, the state constitution is probably a desirable thing, but in the short run, it's not. You know, the Native Claims Settlement hasn't been that long, and it wasn't, you just don't wipe out tradition instantly with congressional action and settle it with cash and land. It's more complicated than that. And so the...
And so what you're saying, that in the long run, the state constitution, where it's supposed to be equal access for everybody, is that what you mean about the state constitution?
Yeah, that you cannot discriminate on the basis of race. Whereas the Alaska Native Claims Settlement and Alaska National Interest Land both provide some special consideration for Native people. Not a lot, but
in some sense. Well, there was that subsistence priority.
Right.
That if a resource has to be limited, then subsistence would get the priority.
Yeah. But this under federal law, where federal, like waterfowl, for example, no, migratory birds, for example, natives can be allowed to gather eggs from seabirds, mm-hmm. but non-natives can't, those kind of things.
Right. Well, and as they say, that federal subsistence priority thing, I don't know if it said native versus non-native. It just says subsistence. And then that leads to the whole debate about, well, what is subsistence?
Yeah.
Can a non-native person be a subsistence person? I mean, it gets into a whole
other
debate.
And so state defines subsistence in a different way than federal might.
So that gets into, that's getting all the way away from the wildlife and the science behind what's happening with the animal population into a whole nother political arena. But, you know, you have talked about before with the management of wildlife and those decisions being made by biologists versus people doing wildlife management who are not biologists.
Right.
And how that affects things.
Right. Yeah, the problem is a lot of people, hunters and non-hunters, say, you know, why do the professionally trained biologists should be the ones that could make all these decisions? But, you know, this sort of doesn't work that way because they're not trained to consider the interests of special interest groups like native cultures and communities, and which are not all the same everywhere. They're highly variable. And that's where local advisory is the representation is important.
What about the people running these agencies, like the head of Fish and Game or the head of the Department of Wildlife Conservation, whatever it's called now, or Department of Natural Resources? They are not always trained biologists. They are not trained biologists.
Well, some of them might be, but not all.
Would it be better if they were, or is it better if they're not?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it depends on how under the state constitution, the commissioner, deputy commissioners, and heads of divisions can be political appointees. I think that's the way it is. But maybe it isn't with the head of divisions. I don't know about that. I think it is. And so the early on, this new State Department of Fish and Game was headed by a PhD, Fisheries Clarence Anderson, who was he'd been on the faculty at the University of Washington, but he had been worked as a commissioner down there, Washington State, and so he was professionally trained, and then he appointed people as deputy commissioner and as division heads who were also professionally trained. This stayed that way. After he retired, then the next one was, I think, a professionally trained person who had been a deputy commissioner or something before. And then there were some of our students, like Ron Skoog, who did a master's degree here through the wildlife unit, and he and Caribou, he became commissioner, and Jim Brooks also became commissioner of Fish and Game, although he had started working for the Alaska Department of Fisheries under Clarence Anderson a couple of years before statehood, and he was doing studies on marine mammals, including just yesterday John Burns and I were discussing this, and he was studying sea lions, walrus, and polar bears, and beluga whales in the Anishinaabeg River, particularly, and what they were trying to, nobody knew anything about beluga whales, and so he sort of volunteered, but he was recommended by Clarence Anderson to go up there and what could they find out about how much salmon were these things eating, and so and were they new, were they single animals that come up, or were they ones that were coming back? And so Jim was one of the first to figure out how to capture them. And
was that in the 60s?
Pardon?
What time period was that?
That would have been in the in the 50s.
In the 50s, okay.
In 57 or so. And he was able to catch some of these belugas, and he learned a hell of a lot. And yeah. He was a really excellently trained and a good scientist, even though he didn't start out that way. He had the training, but he had been in pilot in the war and done a lot of bombing out of the Europe from England, and mm-hmm. and then he had before the war he grew up in Detroit, and he was this outdoor guy, and he finally wanted to leave home, and his dad said, well, we don't have any money to send you any place. I mean, you gotta get a job and do things. And I want to go, and I can hop a train and what or something, and which he did. He was going to go. He didn't have any money, and his father gave him like $20, I think. And so he rode the trains to, and he somehow got into Canada and did worked in woods work for a while. And and worked his way to Southeast and Ketchikan. And he, in the meantime, the war had started, and he was considered by the Canadians a draft dodger. He hadn't even thought about the war. And he went to Ketchikan, and he worked briefly for the CCC.
Mm-hmm. Civilian Conservation Corps.
Yeah. Then doing some logging, trail building, and then he met somebody and they went commercial fishing. So, and he learned about that. And then he wanted to see more of Alaska, so he went, he was able to get a boat ride to the Seward or someplace, and went up to Anchorage, and then he decided he wanted to go trapping. And so he went and trapped over in the Kantishna area for a couple of years, got his, put together a dog team, and he trapped for 2 or 3 years, trapped wolves and other animals, and got that out of his system. And then he came back, and I think about that time he decided, well, maybe I should register and go to war. Maybe I have a responsibility. So he did, and he ended up quickly, because he was a doer, he was able to get selected for pilot training, and he became a bomber pilot and led a squadron, bomber squadron, with a very good record. And then he retired, or the war was over, and he came back, and he went to the Seward Peninsula, spent time there, and he knew how to fly then. And so he was doing flying. He married a native woman and worked for the Weather Service, and he finally worked with some with reindeer herding a little, not with, no, I don't think he worked with, he knew about, he just checked it out, I think. But then he finally was offered this job down in, he came to university.
He got a degree at some point.
He got a degree, and he brought his wife with him, and she also got a degree, Native woman. And so, yeah, he got the degree, and then he started working part-time, I think, for this new fishery agency, and or maybe he worked for the federal government. But then he even wanted to go on for he did a master's degree here, and he wanted to go on and maybe do a PhD at the University of British Columbia. And I don't think, he might have gone down for one semester, but then they got offered this job, and then statehood, he went to work for them as heading up the game division.
And so then the difference now is that the people in these commissioner and department level positions are no longer professionally trained people?
It changed gradually. I mean, it was, I think, under the Hickel administration was the first time there was someone who was made commissioner of fish and game was either shoe salesman or clothing salesman in Arden Hunter in Anchorage. And I remember the wildlife faculty wrote a letter in opposition to it, and indirectly we were told that Hickel might be considering cutting the funding for the university if we push that.
And so what difference do you think it's made to have these political appointees no longer be professionally trained?
Well, In practice, you should be able to have someone who is not necessarily professionally trained to be commissioner. And but it set a precedent that we didn't approve of, and partly because he was this guy had been really supported Hickel's campaign for governor. And so this was a reward, and that's a major problem. I mean, someone in a position like that, it's not because they had good qualifications necessarily to be commissioner, and he didn't have much experience about fisheries or wildlife. He hunted wildlife, but I don't think he had any experience about fishing and commercial fishing at a. And it is hard to get someone who's trained in all of those areas or understands all those areas well. So then over time, I'm not sure whether I can say this statement with that I'm knowledgeable enough about the situation, but it seemed to me it got worse maybe under the Murkowski governorship.
Mm-hmm.
And that got some of that toughness there was the Murkowski didn't approve of the work that the state was doing up with caribou at Prudhoe Bay. So the state supported, was in the oil industry initially. It was a split money. The oil industry and the state, the oil industry agreed to support a person up there if the state put in half of it or something like that. So this guy, Ray Cameron, who did a PhD here at the university, he was a pilot, and he got assigned to work and monitor the movements of the caribou, because the question was being raised, is the pipeline and the haul road fracturing the central Arctic herd? And so he did all these survey flights, and so the oil industry didn't like his findings. He was showing that, it's being fractured. There's now two separate calving grounds, and the bulls tend to move across more readily the pipeline and the haul road than cows, and cows with calves. And so it's fracturing the herd. The herd was staying fairly stable and increasing a little bit. And it was, the oil industry say everything's fine here, And at the same time, other herds were increasing more rapidly. So the porcupine and others were increasing more rapidly. And so then the oil industry hired a consulting firm that was known to do the bidding of the oil industry if the oil industry funded. So they hired a team to, especially this one guy who had a PhD from Yale in forestry, and hired him to, supported him to do, I think hired him, and he worked with the team, and they used bigger aircraft. And did some of flying some of these same routes that Ray Cameron was flying with the Super Cub, and claimed they were coming up with different kind of data that suggested he was wrong in his studies, and so this got to be real iffy, touchy issue. And so finally, the wildlife profession stood behind the state guy. And about that time, the oil industry withdrew their funding for him. So it was all funded by Fish and Game. And so, and then I'm pretty sure this was under Murkowski. So then they tried to publish data on the stuff that they had, and the journal Arctic, and we paper was sent out for review to some of us, and well, it wasn't good science, and we pointed that out, and so they couldn't get this stuff published, and they really, we made the case, and environmental groups, we passed this information on to environmental groups like the Northern Environmental Center and others, and said, you know, the Cameron's work has been published, and it's withstood the criticism, review, et cetera, but so that it wouldn't. And so it was that Murkowski then, one of the things he tried to do is this guy was working for this consulting firm. He was based in Anchorage, and so he tried to get him hired in as a deputy commissioner of Fish and Game, and with the idea of moving him in to become commissioner of Fish and Game. And that stirred up a big controversy, because it was so obvious that this was a political, and for this particular case where his had been shown that he had, you know, did the bidding of the oil industry rather than doing the science like ABR has a record for. And so then this carried on for quite a while, and he didn't get, when it came to filling the position, he didn't get appointed to the commissioner position. And he was becoming, you know, a real activist and criticizing Fish and Game's work as well as any other work that was being done on the oil industry or on caribou up there. And so then Murkowski pulled a shrewd one. He contacted the head of Carol Lewis, who was head of the Agriculture and Land Resource Management,
the department here at the university,
and said, "We've got to give you a full fledged faculty member," and she was not the greatest person in this regard. She went where the money was and was political too, and so she announced that they had this position that she was being offered and considering. So I don't know whether she asked for the response from the faculty or not. I think she did, because the faculty required that, really, that they have a voice in it. So the faculty contacted us and the wildlife program, and said, "Whoa, this is a disaster. She's just trying to push this thing through. And we don't think this guy is, and we think if we just stand up by ourselves, she'll just hold it against us." So we all wrote letters and said, we reviewed his application and said, in effect, no, he's not qualified, and this isn't the way we fill positions. And so it was a no vote of the faculty in land resource management as the outside other biologists in the area, because he was being hired as sort of a wildlife biologist by them. And so, she couldn't pass up having a faculty member, so she went ahead and she was, of course, in the good graces of Murkowski, and they hired this guy and assigned him to the Agriculture Experimental Station in Palmer. And yet he was supposed to teach courses, so it was like he could teach courses in both Fairbanks and UAA, but he was being employed by UAF, here through the Agriculture and Land Resource Management, but he would be based in Palmer because the faculty said they didn't want him here.
Right.
So he offered a couple of courses, and he did it through like teleconference kind of course. He came up and gave a couple of seminars, and I had a grad student, and she took one of his seminars, was on a reading assignment, and then they would discuss it. And she said, oh man, this guy is, he's just not scientific, he's not objective, and she just was very unhappy with this thing. And I don't blame her. And so then, and he still has some kind of affiliation with the university, and he still sits down there, and they don't send him up here any longer. I sat in on a couple of his seminars, and, you know, he could see it was teleconference, so he knew I was there. And he tried two or three times to get us to join in with him, people up here, and he said, you know, what's the basis for this? And, to do some more research up on the North Slope. And it was obvious that he was not be an objective scientist. So at any rate, when it came on and we said, well, I'm glad to see Dr. Klein is there, you know. See, he tried to butter us all up, you know, and we had been opposing what he was doing. And so at any rate, it was, you'd ask these questions and he would try to weasel his way out. And then, you know, the only thing he'd accomplished, he had given the seminar up here when he wasn't there.
And I suppose you don't want to say his name.
I can't remember his name, but
okay.
I will think of it. If I know, I would be glad to tell you his name.
Well, you said something in a sentence that I'm not sure I understood. So you said, you know, somebody who's doing this science funded by the oil industry, and so he came out with pro-oil industry data. And then you said you compared him to science, to the work at ABR. Were you saying ABR is doing the same thing, or they're doing something different?
No, I'm saying they have a reputation of not being bought by the oil industry, but they do good work with the oil industry. The oil industry uses them because they want the data to be accepted.
Okay.
And good.
That's what I thought you were saying, but the way the sentence came out, it was not necessarily.
I'll think of this other guy's name.
Anyway, I just want to clarify that.
He has done some good science. He does a lot of DNA work on reindeer and caribou, and he's still doing some of that kind of stuff.
But all of that was because we were talking about people appointed to the
right
commissioner and department level who were not professionally trained.
And then it got worse under Palin governorship. Palin governorship. And it's continued that way.
And what I'm hearing you say is that you think it would be better if these appointments were professionally trained people.
Right. And not politically motivated. Under Palin, she appointed this guy who had a correspondence degree in wildlife conservation from down in the lower 48, someplace west. And he lived in Wasilla, and he might have worked briefly for Fish and Game. Rossi, I think it was his name.
Yeah, that's a familiar name.
And so she put him head of the division of game, I think. And then he was involved in some illegal hunting activity for black bears on the Kenai. I was just so stupid to get involved in something like that.
Right. So if they're professionally trained, you feel like they understand the issues better and what the science the biologists bring to them, and that the decisions are made better?
That's definitely would be the major concern. But in addition, that was politically motivated, and then they put all attention on, say, wolf control, and ignore everything else, so they ignored, and not only that, but then they started moving people around in the Division of Wildlife Conservation and dismissing, the fellow that was head of the Division of Wildlife Conservation was the guy that had worked up through it, and he was just top-notch guy. He had a degree from the University of Idaho, I think it was, or maybe it was Missoula, Montana, but he was just a top-notch guy. He was great for the wildlife unit. He was very supportive of it, and they'd come up with funding for student projects that were important for the department. And he had been regional biologist in Southeast, but he had been up South Central Alaska. But I know him pretty well, and he's really a top-notch guy. And he was liked so much by people working under him that just the morale went after that, moving him out of there. It affected the morale of the whole department. It's never recovered from that since then.
Okay. Well, shall we call it a night?
Fair for me, yeah.
Have you said everything you need to say on this?
No, there's a lot more to say, but no, I'll write more
okay
for this.
We'll talk about it more next time, maybe.
Yep.